Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me? I check my bell vibes every day in the sugar.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Steve. Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary to you, lady friend.
We survived 1 year of Dear Sugar Radio, and listeners, you survived it with us.
Yes. And you know, we received literally thousands of letters this year, and even more remarkably, read every one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All kinds of topics. Friendship, infidelity, motherhood, single fatherhood, sibling rivalry, addiction, breakups, coming out, mm-hmm. body image, the teenage years. There isn't one subject that we're not interested in discussing on the show. And it's been fabulous that we've had the opportunity to talk about so many.
And within all of those different subjects, we find the same themes, or they're really kind of questions coming up over and over again. They're just kind of wrapped in a different context. The central one is, you know, kind of, do I have the right to feel what I'm feeling? But even more kind of fundamental existential questions, will I ever not feel this way? Can I ever escape my past? I love that the questions that people are bringing are really fundamental questions. And so for this first anniversary episode, what we're really going to do is hear from some people, you know, for whom we gave advice.
Yeah, well, we do in a fair number of the letters we answer, we hear from the letter writer. And that's always a delight and really interesting to hear their take on the experience they had listening to us answer and discuss their letter. And sometimes we even get to hear a bit about what happened next. And later in the show, we are actually going to call a couple of those people and hear what happened next, which mm-hmm. I think is super exciting, a historic moment on Dear Sugar Radio.
But before we get to that, I want to ask you, Cheryl, is there a particular letter or show that has haunted you or that has stayed with you, that you've thought about, either in the content of the letter or in the advice that we gave the letter writer?
Actually, several of them. And I think it's such an interesting dynamic. This happened to me also when I was writing the Dear Sugar column, is that obviously, you know, in writing the column, I crafted an answer. In doing the radio show, you and I spend a lot of time sitting here in the studio talking to each other and trying to hash through all the different issues that come up when we're essentially grappling with any one particular person's letter. But what ends up happening is when these episodes go out into the universe and our listeners hear them and then start to write to us, that they're saying, well, okay, you didn't think about this, or I disagree with you about that, or why didn't you make a point about this? And what's fascinating to me is so often I'm not in conflict with those emails that disagree or dispute or ask other questions. We really are having a conversation on this show. And sometimes somebody emails us and I think that is a good point, or I didn't quite think of it in that light, even though I agree with what this person is saying. I didn't get to it in my own mind when you and I were discussing it on single hour. And so I do feel those episodes where I feel that the most strongly, they're the ones that stay with me. One that comes to mind for me is our Big Love episode, when we interviewed my friend Ariel Greenberg and we answered questions from people who are in polyamorous relationships. And it was interesting to me, we got two kinds of letters and I got two kinds of responses on my social media. One category, you know, was the people who said, wow, you know, thank you so much for discussing polyamory and exploring what is still thought of as a very alternative kind of relationship. And then we got this other category of responses and letters from people who said, basically, you know, you must be joking. This is pure bullshit. And my response when I received those two kinds of letters is that I realized that I didn't entirely express my true thinking and feeling on that show, because, of course, I want to be like I am totally open to this idea that people have all sorts of relationships. I absolutely am that. But I do wonder, you know, I don't feel like I'm in a position where I should be giving anyone advice about whether this, you know, polyamory is a workable model or not. And so I felt like I was really grappling and didn't necessarily reveal all of the questions I have and doubts, frankly, about, you know, how those relationships sustain themselves over time.
Yeah.
What's interesting to me, I guess the most interesting thing to me about that particular episode is I do feel like that it's a great example of this very thing I'm talking about, that you and I are in a conversation. We really are, I think, in so many ways, hoping that our conversation sparks other conversations in our listeners. And so, yeah, I think that we did that in the polyamory episode. And I think that having, you know, these two sides kind of react so strongly is in some ways a success, even though in a lot of ways it also made me uneasy because I thought, well, what did we accomplish in that show? What did we illuminate? And maybe the thing we did is just simply begin that conversation that I think a lot of people have in private or wonder about in private.
I'll tell you, the episode that really kind of leaps out to me, it was an early show that we did, Cheryl, and the letter that we handled, it was really one of the most intense letters that we got, was from a young woman who was writing about the struggle with having been sexually assaulted and not quite knowing, being very guilt-ridden and confused by her, what she saw as her complicity in that arrangement. It was a very complicated letter, as you've suggested. It was not a black and white discussion. But what I remember about that taping in particular, as we got deeper and deeper into this realization that sexual assault is something that you carry with you, it brought you back very powerfully to a scene that you had witnessed as a young girl between your mother and father, which was not consensual sex. It was sexual assault as you understood it then, I think, instinctually and later in your life. And what to me was remarkable about that was, you know, part of what makes you a special person is that you were there emotionally, really having to re-experience that in some ways in the moment. And I think for listeners, and especially the letter writer, I think she understood that you knew exactly what she was struggling with in a deeply personal way. And it was very moving to see you be willing to go there.
Thank you. I do think that that is really the purpose of this show. And it's, in a lot of ways, it harkens back to what I was just saying about the polyamory episode, is that we're always offering advice, opinions, perceptions from the vantage point of our own lives. Okay, we bring with us, you bring with you the experience you had, you know, as a child growing up with, you know, the family that you lived in, and I do the same. And so we're always narrating those stories, whether we're doing them explicitly or not. In the case of discussing polyamory, you know, we talked to Ariel Greenberg, who has, you know, she has a stake in making this kind of relationship legitimate. And I have a stake in making a monogamous relationship legitimate, you know? And I think that to be as honest and transparent about that as possible really serves us when it does come to digging into whatever insight we can offer to the people who write to us. We can say, you know, I am not just the blank slate. And no offense to people like Dear Abby, who I think, you know, has done great work, you know, obviously a trailblazer in the world of advice. But what's always been most interesting to me, whether it be in the Dear Sugar column or on this show, is that we are actually presenting ourselves as entirely subjective beings who are coming from a particular vantage point.
Mm-hmm. Our listeners, what's been lovely to see over the past year is that our listeners return that. You know, we are kind of a little bit more raw, the nerves are more exposed, and when they write to us, for good or bad, they continue that conversation in a way that's much more honest than they probably are oftentimes with, you know, their own family. So that's felt like a real gift to have, as we'll see as we move forward, people writing back with that same intensity and honesty. So let's move on to some of the responses that we've gotten to our other shows.
Great. The first is from this young man who calls himself Guilty One. He grew up in Kentucky. He's living now in Southern California and training as an actor. And he's gay. And he was not out to his family. And when he wrote us this letter, he had just learned that his beloved mother was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And his family was very homophobic, and he was really struggling with this question of whether he should tell his family the truth about who he was, and especially tell his mother at this time when mm-hmm. she was really struggling with this illness. We had our guest, the wonderful writer George Hodgman, on the show, and we all sort of fell down on the side of the guilty one should come out to his mother, though we also had some caution about that. We were fearful of the consequences of that decision. We warned him that he might not hear what he wanted to hear when mm-hmm. he made that revelation. But we also said that, you know, the higher price to pay would be to have this relationship with his mother and with his family, where he was essentially hiding himself from them.
Right.
Here's George Hodgman addressing the complexity of whether the letter writer should come out to his mother. Let's listen back to it.
Yeah.
I think that there's not an easy yes or no answer here. I think he has to really keep an open heart and kind of go with what the situation gives him. I hope he does, because I think that lack of acceptance is something that, in my experience, you really do have to deal with them. You know, you have to get this kind of affirmation from your parents. It's very important. But what I feel, you know, it's like if you're gay like he was and you're growing up in this very hostile situation, he's obviously absorbed so much, you know, he has so much internalized homophobia himself,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, exacerbates the situation so much.
So many people wrote into us about this episode, and they were very moved by it. A whole bunch of people wrote in actually to express a certain amount of concern, not so much that Guilty One's mother might not react as he hoped she would, but that his family might blame him if his mother's health were to deteriorate after he spoke to her. And there was one letter in particular that was quite striking. "Dear Sugars, I love your podcast. I have some misgivings about the advice you gave to Guilty One. In general, I think you were right. I heard the yearning to come out and be accepted in the text of the letter. If I had been asked, though, based on my experience, I would have strongly advised against it. I'm a lesbian. When I was 17, I put my first tentative toe out of the closet by bringing up the subject with my father. He called me a pervert and sent me to my room. About a week later, my mother blew her head off in the basement. About a month after that, my father and I were having one of our few but devastating fights. We were screaming at each other, and in the heat of the moment, he said, 'You are driving me to suicide the same way you drove your mother to suicide.' He never stated it was because I'm gay. He never had to. I know there were many reasons that led my mom to suicide. Her rejection of my orientation was probably only a small part of it. I also know that my father blamed me for that, probably as a way of deflecting his own guilt. The whole soup has had a devastating impact on my life. I'm 50 now. I've had therapy. I'm fine and functional, but that floating sense of guilt and the mental and emotional scars never go away. Most parents are not going to have such extreme reactions when their children come out. Most parents will have a temporary denial or a fit of anger, and then their love for their child will change their minds eventually. It did for my father, though the damage had been done. Guilty One's mother may not have the time to work through an initial negative reaction. Add that to the mental and emotional strains of dealing with cancer and chemotherapy, and even a deeply loving parent may end up misdirecting their anger and permanently damaging a child. In a family situation, when a parent dies, even of entirely natural causes, some of the relatives will need to place blame. Coming out to a parent in that situation leaves you vulnerable to being the target of that impulse. On the other hand, Guilty One clearly wants to be honest with his mother, and he isn't a teenager living at home. It's a call he obviously has to make on his own. What I would have said if asked: it's a toxic, unholy mess that can really fuck you up if it goes bad. Think it over several times before you act." And that was from a woman who called herself Voice of Experience.
Yeah, that's a very powerful letter, and it's what I'm talking about when I say that I feel like we're in conversation with our listeners.
Right.
I think that there isn't a right answer here. That maybe my favorite line of this letter, and it's certainly what I think George said and what you said and what I said ultimately to Guilty One, is it's his call to make. He is going to be the one who lives with the consequences, positive or negative, of his decision. And so I'm curious about those consequences. I'm curious about what he made of our advice and what's happened in his life since then. So let's give him a call. He to be ready to talk to us.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Is this Guilty One? I feel odd saying that to you. It sounds accusatory.
Yes, this is Guilty One.
I'm Steve Allman. Also on the line is Cheryl Strayed. We're so happy to talk with you.
Oh, I'm so happy to talk to you, my dear sugars.
Tell us what happened. We're kind of at the edge of our seats here.
Yeah, well, you know, we found out my mother's diagnosis in May, mm-hmm. and I wrote you guys shortly after. And your response came, to my surprise, in July. And Cheryl, you said something, I wrote it down, we don't save people by pretending to be something we're not.
Mm.
So even though my mother was sick, I wanted so much for her to know me for who I am. And my parents actually came up to see me. And I tell you, after I listened to your podcast, it was on the tip of my tongue to just tell them, but I didn't have the courage at that point. And I actually did go home in August. And of course, when I went back home to Kentucky was when, you know, Kim Davis was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everything that was going on with that.
We should just let listeners know Kim Davis was the county clerk from, I believe, Rowan, Kentucky, who mm-hmm. was refusing to sign marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
Right, right. And again, it was on the tip of my tongue. And I didn't have the courage. And it wasn't until early October that I eventually, you know, had enough. So I wrote three letters. I wrote one to my father, one to my mother and my sister. Hmm. And I went to that mailbox three times. One time I almost dropped the letters in and I couldn't do it because my hand was shaking. And
wow.
Then the next time I was like, I'm going to do it. And the third time when I stood in front of that box, and I kissed each letter and I just dropped it in the mailbox. And there was just like this weight lifted. I mean, it was the most simple action, but it took all my strength to do it.
Mm.
Yeah. And then my mother called me about a week after. So she definitely had the letter for a couple days. She called me on the phone. She's like, hey, how are you doing? And then eventually she got around. There's like a long pause in our conversation. She said, so I got your letter. And,
wow.
you know, we started to talk about it, and I said, well, did Dad read the letter? And she said she didn't give it to him. She wanted to wait. She said, I just, you know, let's get through the holidays. And I said, Mom, you can't do this to me. You know, it's not about you. It's about me, and you may not be ready, but I am.
Mm.
And she said, okay, I'll give it to him. And she did, and my dad called me another couple days later, and I could tell that he really had to sit with his thoughts about this. And eventually he came around and he's like, you know, he said, I'm not happy, but you're my son. And since you're my son, I love you.
Mm.
Why do you think they were so shocked?
You know, partly because of me. I mean, anytime I go home to visit, I'm so aware of how I dress, how I talk, what I talk about, almost like a censoring of myself.
Yeah.
I've been in a relationship for the past 3 months with somebody that I met back in September. And I have no doubt that the reason it's my best relationship is because
wow.
I'm allowing myself to be my true self.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, when we did the show, I mentioned to Cheryl, when my twin brother came out, I was mm-hmm. absolutely floored. And it was precisely for the reason that you're talking about, that, you know, part of what people do who are trying to hide anything from family, but especially something as charged as orientation and family that doesn't understand, doesn't accept, is, you know, you become incredibly adept at, and it is censorship. It's a form mm-hmm. of self-censorship, but it's also a form of self-preservation. So you must have been, I mean, clearly you were quite effective in shielding them from something that you knew would be really tough for them to absorb. on the other side of that, it does sound like they are reckoning with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad has even said, he's like, you know, I come from a different generation. You know, if I told my father this, I would have been kicked out on the street. Mm.
So your mom in particular, so much of your letter was about her and your worry about her health. Mm-hmm. And really your recognition that this is something that many of us, we don't want to face and we don't have to face, but that the people we love die. And I think when a family member gets an illness, you contemplate your own mortality and also theirs. And I think this was sort of the engine in your letter. What do I do about my mom? Do I tell my mom? Mm-hmm. I'm curious about how your relationship with her, I know this is still fairly fresh. It's been a few months. Do you feel closer to your mom? You know, has your relationship changed over these months that you've been who you are to her?
Yeah. I know that I upset her. I know that I shocked her. But she's coming around to being more comfortable about it. I mean, we do have our moments. Like, at Thanksgiving, I posted a photo of my boyfriend and I on Facebook, and she said, why don't you take that down? Why don't you delete that post? And I said, well, why? She's like, well, you know, not everybody wants to see that. And I said, well, I'll take it down if my sister and her husband take down the photos of them kissing at Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
And, you know, and at times I find myself getting frustrated with them, but I remember I was scared that I thought that my mother would love me differently, if at all. I still very much feel her love and support. It's just something that's completely new to them. I am their gay son, and they just found this out after 25 years of raising me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And 25 years of, yeah, you very effectively essentially played their straight son.
Yeah.
Right. It's definitely, we're on a journey together. Yeah. I have to put myself in the position of making myself available to her and to my father and to be present to answer their questions that they have, as, you know, stupid as they may be, because they need to know, they need to have their answers, and I need to be there to provide them.
Well, and you probably know lots of people. I think George told the story, but I certainly, so many of my gay and lesbian friends report that journey that you referred to, that it wasn't as if that first moment that you tell your parents I'm gay, that they're going to, you know, be saying the right things and doing the right things. But over time, people can make vast changes on this front, you know, that as they become familiar with, you know, I want to say the new you, but it's really the old you, the you have been all along that you finally decided to share with them. They will let fall some of those biases and judgments that they have about gays and lesbians. And absolutely, you know, there's struggle along the way. But I think it sounds to me, when you begin, as your parents have begun, from that standpoint of love, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. really what you were afraid of. You know, when you wrote to us, you were afraid you would lose their love, and you didn't. Mm-hmm. And now what follows is going to be some frustration, but you might also find that you'll find your way to a new relationship that is far better than the one you've ever had before with them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually living my true self and making myself known.
Mm.
That's so terrific. What should we call him, Cheryl? Courageous one? Unburdened one?
Courageous one. Free one.
Free
wonderful one.
One.
Oh. We wish you all good luck. And, you know, we'd be curious if you care to check in with us down the line as your relationship with your parents evolves. We'll be curious to see how that turns out. Maybe we'll talk to you again this time next year.
Oh, for sure. Let's see what happens.
All righty.
Happy one-year anniversary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hopefully many years to come.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That guy's awesome.
Oh, that was such a sweet story. I love it. You know, and it's a sweet story, even though, you know, his parents did say, like, oh, I'm not happy about this, but
right.
I still love you.
Well, that's a,
and that's,
and
that's
yeah.
the thing. You know, we never thought, okay, this is going to be easy.
Right.
It's not going to be easy. When you have a family who essentially has made it clear that they have problems with people who are gay and lesbian, it's not going to be easy to say, guess what? I am gay or I am a lesbian, you know?
Right.
So I think that this turned out beautifully,
even
if that means there's still some struggle.
Oh, God, of course. I mean, as you said, now they're on the journey together. You know, previous to that, they were not on the same journey. And now they're on the journey together. And I love that he is so obviously reverential and loving towards his folks and esteems them. You know, there's such a sense of respect. And I think that's why he went about coming out to them in a way that he knew they were going to be able to gradually accept. I love that. I think that's so important for people to hear who are struggling with whatever part of themselves they're frightened to present to their family. You have to be patient and loving and accept people where they are. But it's so so wonderful to hear him also feel so joyous and unburdened, because he was doing something that we, as we know from our listeners, that was truly risky. And I love that it's a gift for us, that for our first anniversary, I'll take that as a gift. So Cheryl, as we both know, the three episodes that we got just a flood of emails about and letters was our three-part series on infidelity. You know, that subject had come up so much in our letters that we felt like we had to do a couple of episodes, one on the betrayed and then on the betrayers. And in the course of talking about this stuff, we realized that actually infidelity is so complex and tangled a subject that we needed some expert help. And we managed to track down and somehow dragoon into speaking to us the amazing Esther Perel, this relationship therapist who has made it part of her life's work to investigate the intricacies of infidelity. So let's just listen to a little bit of what she had to say. Here she is responding to our question of whether she would always advise people to tell their partners about an infidelity.
You always ask, what would happen if you tell? What would happen if you don't tell? And sometimes the partner doesn't want to know.
Right.
I have heard so many people in my office say, I wish you'd never told me. Yeah. I wish you'd never told me.
Right. Yeah.
And you don't know. So sometimes when a person asks a question, you even slow it down because you can never take it back. And you just say, do you want to hear the answer to your question or do you want your partner to know that you have the question?
So those listeners who heard this episode on which we interviewed Esther Perel will remember that you and I were like, holy shit. You know, as soon as she was done talking, we were both just really blown away by what she had to say. And that was reflected in our inbox. So many people who wrote to us said essentially the same thing. We heard a lot of stories from listeners in response to these episodes. And one of the big ones was Esther Perel is amazing and sort of blew everyone's minds. One listener responded to this idea that we just heard from Esther, that confessing may not always be the right choice. And to another point of Esther's, that a partner cannot be all things to us. This listener wrote, Steve and Cheryl, thank you for the fabulous three-part series on infidelity. I love the Esther Perel quotes, marriage is not meant to give you happiness, but to give you a life in which you can find happiness yourself. And also, there is freedom and power in transgression. She writes, so true. I've been with my husband since we were teenagers. My family was a mess, and I was searching for connection. I found someone stable, conservative, kind, smart, and funny. 8 years into our stable, rote relationship, I had a passionate, highly charged, short-lived affair with a person I was professionally infatuated with. He was my first career mentor. Later, I left my boyfriend, then came back and married him. Now we're 20 years into our relationship. I found ways to cultivate passion, connection, and drama in my life, in conversation with friends, and in my career, by owning my own business. So I don't expect my sweet, loyal, introverted husband to be everything all the time. I'm 1 week from having my second child. We have a great sex life, tons of intimacy, warmth, fun, and joy. I don't regret not telling him about what I did. We're ridiculously happy. High fives to both of you for helping people tell the true stories of their inner lives. So much sad and beautiful stuff there, like life.
That is so awesome. I love that idea, true stories of our inner lives. That's beautiful. Well, we received a lot of letters that were like that from listeners who'd been through infidelity in their partnerships, and most had survived and grown from it. This one is a little bit more, shall we say, raw. Dear Sugars, I'm not writing with a question, but just thanks for being out there and a description of a scene that I thought might make you happy. Last Wednesday, my husband of 20 years told me he's been having an affair. I don't need to tell you the roller coaster we've been on since this awful news, and your 3-week arc on infidelity has been timely and enormously helpful. But I was rapt listening to Esther Perel this week as she just blurted out in rapid-fire succession her pearls of wisdom. I needed to take notes. That's how Cheryl and I felt, by the way. We felt the exact same way. Anyway, since I no longer eat or sleep, I found myself awake again at 3 a.m. this morning, and I kicked my dumb husband awake and made him listen to the episode with me. So there we were, totally raw and wounded, and not sure we'll make it out of this mess, cuddled up, listening to your podcast, and feeling like maybe there's a glimmer of hope. Thank you for that. I felt better today for the first time.
Oh, wow. My heart goes out to you in that. I think that's a really powerful thing to do in this moment of your life, to kick your husband awake and listen to that together.
I just said, this is my dumb husband. I love that line.
Exactly.
Get up, dummy. You need to hear this.
So those of you who listened might remember that we had part one was letters from people who'd been betrayed, and part two was from those who had done the betraying. And we heard from one of the letter writers from part one, the betrayed, a young woman whose husband of 3 years slept with a prostitute just months after their baby was born. She was rocked by what happened in their new family nest and by the lies he told. The advice we gave her is that, yes, he messed up mightily, and that it was also probably connected to the big moment that you're in, that this transition into becoming parents. And we comforted this woman and assured her that we thought that she could get through this with communication, that even wounds like this we can heal in the course of a long relationship, such as the sort we all hope to have when we're married. She wrote us with an update. She said that they listened to the episode together. Don't you love that idea, Steve, that there's a couple out there to us talk about them? And she said it helped them realize that they were on the right track when it came to communicating better their needs and rebuilding their relationship. She had signed her first letter, Married to a Stranger, and she signed her second letter, Married to a Perfectly Imperfect Man Who Can Sometimes Suck, But Is Mostly Awesome.
Yeah, I love it.
I think you've just described my husband, Married to a Stranger, and it's probably the way he would describe me, too, with the insertion of the word woman instead of man.
Yeah. We also heard from a woman who called herself Heartbroken Heartbreaker, and this was from the second part of Infidelity, the series, the Betrayers part. This is a 39-year-old woman who'd been married to her husband for a decade. They had two young kids, and she had an emotional, a torrid emotional affair with her high school boyfriend, an emotional affair. Her husband found out and forgave her, and things were better than ever. They repaired things, and then, as sometimes happens, she did it again. She was devastated by this. She told us she loved her husband and desperately wanted to make things right, but he said they were done for good this time. It was a very tough letter. And she wrote us a very striking update. Here it is. Dear Sugars, as I drove to work on Monday morning, I eagerly updated my Dear Sugar feed, knowing that I had missed a week while I was in Bermuda celebrating my 10th wedding anniversary with my husband. Imagine my shock when I heard you read my letter. I had sent it 2 days after my husband discovered my repeat betrayal. Thank you so very much for reading it and for your beautiful response. Tears streamed down my face as I drove and listened. Your advice was so spot on, and I'm happy to report that I followed it. A brief update. My husband and I stayed under one roof, but with me sleeping in the guest room. I researched and found a wonderful therapist and began the work, as you called it. We unpacked and explored what the need is in me that led me to touch the fire twice. I spent several months discovering myself. And Steve, you're right. Of course, Cheryl's thinking, of course Steve wanted to read this. And Steve, you're right. The part of me that is a devoted and faithful wife and the part of me that needs attention, affirmation, and danger, that's also me. After those several months, my husband started coming to therapy with me. We have spent this time working on gaining a true and deep understanding of who we are, what we need, and how we fit together. It is the work we should have done the first time when we figured we could just forget it and move on. Cheryl said she hoped we could save our marriage because it sounds like a good one. Our therapist said the same thing at our second meeting. Today, we are closer than ever with a true deep connection and a commitment to continue the work, which we know never ends, although we have been officially deemed fit enough to only check in with our therapist if we feel the need. I'm so happy to report that we made it to our 10th, stronger than we were on any of the previous 9 anniversaries. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart.
That's lovely. And I'm so inspired that these two women who wrote to us from different sides of that fence, betrayed and betrayer,
mm-hmm.
have reported that this difficult thing, as it sounds like, brought both couples closer and to a truer intimacy. Of course, sometimes an affair can actually expose a relationship that does need to end. And we heard back from the 53-year-old man who is married with two boys in high school. He had written to us saying that he wanted so much more from his marriage than what he was getting. He saw his wife as a tiger mom focused on her career and the kids and little else. He said that she didn't seem interested in emotional intimacy and sex. Their sex life was rote and boring. And so he'd been having sexual affairs for many years while traveling for work. He saw it as a necessary evil to remain married. But ultimately what he wanted was a passionate monogamous marriage. Our advice to him was, we pointed out that it didn't seem like that was working. And he had said to us that really he couldn't break through to his wife, that he'd tried to share this desire with her to have their relationship to be more passionate, and she wasn't listening. And we said, you need to come up with a way to make her listen, because really it was unsustainable as it was. We weren't sure if his marriage could be saved, but we wished him luck, and he wrote to us with an update. Dear Sugars, yesterday, listening to your show while biking, I was astounded by Esther Perel's brilliant thoughts on marriage. I felt her words spoke to me and added clarity in an area where I have been tormented by a lack of understanding. I gasped and nearly rode off the road when I heard the letter that followed was my own. It is hard to describe the surreal experience of hearing one's own words spoken directly by others. I do not wish to defend myself. I only wish to end my confusion and suffering. I do not wish for justification, but an end to the conflict I feel inside. I think of the words of Esther Perel and think that I should stop thinking of what my wife does not provide. Rather, I should think about what it is in my life that I want, and what on that list my marriage supports and hinders. I could accept what my wife can offer and find other life qualities elsewhere. This includes sex and connection. However, she has made it clear that despite her lack of investment, sexual and emotional exclusivity is a non-negotiable term. I have passed a point of no return. I can see no possibility of living on the meager connection and passion that my wife and I share. A marital therapy appointment has been made. I'm resigned not to make things work, but to end things with kindness and fairness. I have to say goodbye to the home and family dynamic I cherish. I have to look into the sad and disappointed eyes of those I love most and offer the words, I'm so sorry. Signed, Married Man.
Mm. And that's also sometimes the way that it goes. And, you know, I think the part of what Esperel was suggesting, and we were coming around to realizing in that episode, is, you know, the preservation of the marriage is not always the end goal. The end goal is to be living more truthfully within whatever arrangement you come to. And, you know, it's not easy to read that the episode gave him clarity in that particular way, but it's quite clear from his tone and what he's been able to tell us that it was time for him to be in a different arrangement. I like at least that he's recognizes that decision should be marked with a sense of apologizing, because there's going to be a lot of pain that results from that decision.
Yes, but you know, I think that sometimes divorce, ending a relationship, it seems like the saddest thing that can possibly happen in the era during which it's happening. But then years down the road, oftentimes both parties involved in that relationship will look back and say that was an awakening for them. It was a beginning. It was the beginning of a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Married Man, what I wish for both you and your wife, and it sounds to me you wish the same thing for both you and your wife, is that you find that life that you seek. And, you know, it's not working for you, this marriage, but it's not working for her either.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever pain and sorrow you're experiencing now, you know, it's all, let's hope, you know, in the search of happier days for your whole family. Good luck to you.
Yeah. So the last letter writer who we'll hear from identifies herself as tired and confused. You might remember this. Her parents were visiting for the first time since the birth of her little baby girl. They live in another state. And her father, who is an alcoholic, relapsed in her home. She caught him sneaking gin from her liquor cabinet and asked him to fly home early. She was devastated that he would relapse in front of her at such a fragile, beautiful time for her. in the letter that she wrote to us, several weeks had passed since this episode, and he had made no efforts to repair the situation. She was wondering what to do and where and how she should establish boundaries with him. And it was a really a tough letter. She's really in the thick of it, as are so many of our letter writers. I think the best thing we can do is to give her a call.
Hello?
Hello, this is Cheryl Strayed. Are you the letter writer who calls herself tired and confused?
Yes, that is me.
It's lovely to talk to you. Steve Almond is here with me as well.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. Our big question really is, what has happened? You know, what has been the path of this relationship? When we talked about your letter, it was not at all clear whether your father was going to come back into your life and under what terms. What has happened?
Yeah, a lot has happened since then, so I'll definitely give you the rundown. It was pretty surreal to hear that you guys have picked my letter, and quite a profound experience to hear you talk about it. At the time that this show actually aired, it was a few months after, you know, the initial incident that I wrote to you about, and I was just about to go visit my parents.
Wow.
Yeah, I really wasn't sure how I was going to handle it with my dad, because we really hadn't talked about it much, you know, what had happened. And, you know, after I listened to the show and to your advice, I really took a lot of it to heart. And so when I went to visit, you know, I was proactive, as you recommended, and made sure that he and I had a time to talk, just the two of us, about what happened. And I actually said to him pretty much verbatim what you recommended, which was, you know, I love you. I know you love me. I want you to be a good father and grandfather, and you can't do that when you're drinking. Mm. And his response, it was very clear that he wasn't even sure that I loved him, because he has so much self-doubt.
Mm.
As you guys very astutely, you know, noted in your response, that it's really about how much he, you know, hates himself and doubts himself. And, you know, it was really to the point where he, you know, I think didn't know that I loved him. And so just hearing me say that was meaningful for him, and kind of opened up the lines of communication between us that hadn't been there in a while. And it enabled him to hear, you know, some of the other tough things that I had to say, one of which was, you know, I'm not ready for you to come back and visit me yet, and I don't know when I'll be ready. But we agreed that, you know, we would aim for him coming to see me in a few months, when I was going to be hosting sort of a special family gathering, and to work towards that. And then in the intervening months, I went back for another visit, and it became clear during that visit that he was still drinking.
Mm.
And behaving in ways that were pretty damaging to all of his relationships, not just his relationship with me. And, you know, it was pretty disappointing after the conversation we'd had, and after the work he said he was going to do to try to make things better. And I went, at some point during that visit, I went for a walk in the woods, and I listened to the, you know, original episode where you had responded to my letter. And, you know, it felt very appropriate to be walking through the woods and listening, Cheryl, to your voice in my ear. You know, I listened to it two or three times and really came to some clarity that I hadn't reached before. And, you know, I don't know what it was about that moment, but, you know, a couple pieces of advice that you had given really stuck with me. One being, you know, the life, you know, that I have to protect is my own, and the life of my daughter and my husband. And not only do I have the right to do that, but in a way I have the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it's, you know, it's okay to set those boundaries. You know, really after this point, I felt in a situation like I had no control, that I was subject to his behavior. And I really realized that I do have some agency in this. So I, you know, made the tough call to tell him that I didn't feel comfortable having him come out to visit and be a part of this, you know, family gathering that was happening.
Hmm. I love the strength and clarity in your voice. And I really, I smiled when you said, I don't know what it was about that particular time when I finally internalized this idea, essentially, that love and boundaries are two separate things. That you can say to somebody, I absolutely love you. I will be here for you when you need me. But I need to set this boundary for my life. You cannot drink in my company or in my daughter's company anymore. And that's, you know, I can tell you this, if your dad, first of all, it's, I mean, it sounds like he's really had a struggle with alcoholism and has tried to be sober many times and has relapsed. And this is how it is for a lot of alcoholics. Many people who do reach a point where they're able to maintain their sobriety can tell you stories of all the times that they failed at that they relapsed. And so, you know, I think that your father has such great potential. And I can promise you that whatever dark times he needs to go through before he reaches that place where he decides to change his life, one of the things that will absolutely help him is that you told him, I love you and I'm setting a boundary. That you've actually given him a consequence to essentially the behavior he's shown you. And I think that that's really one of the most loving things that we can do to people who are making bad choices in their own lives.
Mm. Yeah, and I, you know, I feel like my dad is, we have been through this many times, and from my perspective, he's been at rock bottom before. So, you know, in many ways, we've been here before, but I feel different in how I feel about, you know, my role and everything feels different.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And that's it. It doesn't mean that you're going to feel great about the state that your father's in. I mean, you called yourself tired and confused for a reason. Right. But there are things that you can do for yourself. Like you said, that you get to make choices about not every aspect of the situation, but about some aspects. And all the aspects you get to make choices about are your own life and how you're going to respond to your father and his behavior. That's very empowering when you just decide to own those decisions.
Absolutely.
So I have to ask before we let you off the line, how your baby girl and how your little family is doing?
We're doing awesome. She is so fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
Her family is doing great, yeah. You know, in the times that she and my dad have been together, they have a lot of fun together. So, you know, part of this whole situation is just sadness for him and for her that, you know, that his behavior may prevent as much of a relationship as I know he would like to have with her. But like you say, I mean, I do think there's hope in this situation. And I hope that the relationship with her is a motivation for him. You know, I think having her, being a mother, is part of where the clarity has come for me. You know, having her in my life and wanting to build the family that I want, you know, build that family for her and with her.
That's wonderful. So, you know, we will hope with you.
Thank you. Really meant a lot to me over the past year to have your words to listen to.
Well, thank you so much. We couldn't do the show if people like you didn't write in to us, and we wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, have a great 2016.
Yeah. Thank you. You too.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you know, it's so intense, Cheryl, because, you know, I think our fantasy, obviously, is, well, we'll give this our attention and our intention, and we'll find a solution. And it was so clear that there was a really powerful breakthrough that she made, but it was within herself. And, you know, her dad hasn't got there and may never. But it's powerful to hear that it's possible to have a successful outcome that isn't exactly the one that she was writing about.
Well, you know, and I think it's certainly the one, in my advice, that it was the outcome I was hoping for. Obviously, the best case scenario is that her father hears this from her and decides that this is it. He has hit the rock bottom, and now he's going to be sober and stay sober. But really, that's not up to her. Tired and Confused wrote to us seeking counsel for her own life. And the only thing that we could offer her is this idea that she is responsible for her life. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, sadly, setting boundaries with people who are causing her to suffer.
Right.
And some of those people just happen to be people we love. Yeah. They happen to be people who are very close to us and who we want to be in our lives. And so I have to say, I truly, deeply felt such happiness in my heart to hear the clarity and calm with which tired and confused, explain this situation to us.
Right.
That even though it hasn't yet turned out the way we hope it will, she's at peace with her part of it, which I think is incredibly powerful and really all in the end that we can do.
Yeah. You cannot avoid disappointment. It's absolutely impossible to avoid disappointment. The only thing you can do in certain circumstances is with real grace and clarity manage that disappointment. That's what I heard, is that she knows that she's taking the right course, and that was powerful to hear.
So we, of course, couldn't do this show without you, our listeners, and so we ask you to continue to join us in the year ahead. Send us your letters. We want to know all your problems. We want to know all your secrets. And, you know, I will say that we also want to receive your insight. As we heard today in this episode, we've loved reading, and I hope you've loved hearing, some of the insights that those who've written to us with their problem then gain after thinking about this issue more deeply, after Steve and I have discussed it with whatever guest we have on. We want to continue the conversation with you. It's our privilege to do so.
Yeah.
And so please write to us. We also get story ideas from you. You know, what are the problems that you want us to address on this show? The only way that they will appear on the show is if you write to us and present them to us.
And really, the conversation begins with the letters we get, and one of the shows that we're super excited, it's actually three shows that will be coming out in the new year, is based on the multitude of letters we got from people essentially asking, am I going to find the one? Am I ever going to find love? So we decided to do this three-part series called The Loneliest Number that will focus on that question in different aspects. And we've got a whole bunch of super exciting guests for that, including Lena Dunham. You know, she was just a laser to the truth about that stuff. And we should say, you know, please, in addition to your insights and your feedback, write in to tell us who your dream guest is for next year, who you would like us to be talking to, because we really do consider it to be, essentially, we sort of create the show with the audience.
So, Steve, if you could just have any guest on, it has to be a living person. It has to be somebody who could really actually
you know,
be on.
The living guests are usually better.
Not the dead.
We've had the dead guests, and they're just
lousy conversationalists. Well, you know, those questions are like, oh, if you, the writer dinner party, and it's always
right.
You know.
I would talk to Abraham Lincoln.
So who would you have on the show if you could just, you know, have anyone?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, there's a lot of writers who I would love to snag, because we all have our writer crushes, you know. But this is going to sound crazy, but I just would love, I don't know what question she would answer, and I know that it will never happen, so it's just my own little pipe dream, like crush. I would love to have Michelle Obama. I would
just love
to get her on Dear Sugar. Every time I see her, she is just all kinds of awesome. So, I don't know. That's my dream. What's your dream? Who's your dream?
Oh, you know, you're so not fair.
I took it away from
you? You took it away from me. I was going to say Michelle Obama, because I think she's just like the coolest, smartest person. And so I'm going to say her friend, and my friend as well, Oprah Winfrey.
Ah.
I think we should just shoot for the stars and ask both of them to be on together.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Just tell us what to do.
That sounds great. You can call Oprah, and I will send an email to the White House.
You know, after Oprah restarted her book club for a while, everywhere I went, people in the Q&As at my events would say, did you have that on your vision board? Was it on your vision board to have Oprah pick your book? And I really was sort of not up on this Oprah stuff with the vision board. And so I had to do my research, and I found out that Oprah has encouraged this thing called a vision board, where you put up, you know, like pictures and quotes and, you know, things that you want to have true. So Steve, I'm going to give you some advice. Go home and put up in your bedroom the Dear Sugar Radio vision board. And
are you kidding? What do you think is in my bedroom?
And if President Obama is listening, maybe he could let Michelle know.
Right.
And
exactly.
We'd take him too. We would. You know, if the president can helicopter in to talk to Marc Maron, I think he can come talk to Dear Sugar Radio.
My soul is so weary. My soul is so weary. My soul is a weary. I said my soul is a weary now.
Dear Sugar Radio is produced by WBUR in Boston.
We are produced and edited by the miraculous Lisa Tobin.
We're recording today at Talkback Sound and Visual in Portland, Oregon. Our sound engineer is Josh Millman. You can write to us at dearsugarradio@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. please, please, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also listen to us on the WBUR website, where beneath each episode you'll find the show notes. That is all the songs we play that you love and always write to us asking who did them, mm-hmm. and books we reference and so forth.
Who will comfort me? Day, love, day.